Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Gail Johnson, attorney registration number 29703, and I represent Mr. Montero Romero in this criminal appeal. I just want to advise the court, I have been fighting back laryngitis, so if my voice breaks this afternoon, that's why. I was going to begin my remarks today addressing the erroneous denials of the challenges for cause, specifically to Juror S and Juror B. And I think this court can decide Mr. Montero Romero's appeal on Juror S alone, who had a statement of bias in favor of the police and the prosecutor. This case is very much controlled by the Colorado Supreme Court's decisions in Wilson and in Naylor and a number of other opinions we've cited in our briefs. But I think the Wilson language is particularly appropriate here, because what the court says in Wilson is, notwithstanding the general deference to trial court assessments of credibility under an abuse of discretion standard, if there is no basis in the record for the trial court's finding that a particular prospective juror is impartial, the appellate court must reverse. And I think that's exactly the situation that we have here. The court, of course, is required to look at the entire voir dire. We have set that forth in our opening brief for the court's convenience. And if the court looks at the statement of bias, there's no question that prospective juror S made a clear statement of bias. As background, prospective juror S was a security guard, and he himself had been the victim of a home burglary. This, of course, was a case in which burglary was one of the charges. In response to a question from the deputy district attorney during voir dire about whether he was a fair guy who could listen to the evidence, Juror S stated, quote, "I'm a security guard. I do have a bias in favor of the police and you prosecuting guys. I believe if those two," and I think the record is pretty clear that there's a law enforcement officer sitting with the other prosecutor at counsel table, "I believe if those two didn't believe with all their heart, none of us would be here." And it's interesting what happens next. The deputy district attorney tries to rehabilitate him, says, let's say you listen to the evidence and you don't think it's there. And you think, certainly Mr. Prosecutor's sitting there, so I'm going to go with him. And Juror S says, quote, "If it was a borderline, on-the-fence kind of deal, I think I would lean towards the prosecutor," end quote. Later on, during the defense counsel's voir dire of the same juror, Juror S...
Before you go there, Ms. Johnson, let me ask you about the next question asked by the prosecutor. And I just want to ask you, how do you interpret this question and answer? Because it's a little bit ambiguous. Prosecutor, after the borderline response from Juror S, the prosecutor asks, "Are you sure you would do that, or just based on your experience?" And the juror says, "Yes." I'm not sure how to interpret that. Can you help me with that?
I'll try, Your Honor. I think it is a confusing exchange because the prosecutor asks an either-or question and the juror gives a simple yes response. But I would submit respectfully that under either scenario, there's a problem there. Based on his experience, you know, his feelings towards the prosecution or based on his experience. Either way, in a criminal case where the government has the clear burden, inarguable, of proving a case beyond a reasonable doubt, if he finds that it's just not proved, that it's a toss-up, and he's still leaning for the prosecution, that's both a bias towards the prosecution as well as an inability to follow the court's instructions on basic principles of criminal law.
Johnson, to what extent do we have to credit the court's finding that the juror seemed to be overly conscientious?
So, Your Honor, again, I think this goes back to the point in Wilson. If the juror had made other statements, had been rehabilitated, and so there were conflicting statements in the voir dire. On the one hand, we could have a statement of bias. On the other hand, we could have, hypothetically, in a different case, a juror who says, nonetheless, I can set aside that bias, I can judge the evidence fairly, and the trial court could, I think, fairly credit that, and that would be the kind of finding that this court would need to defer to. I don't think this court can defer to the trial court saying he's overly conscientious. It's a clear statement of bias in the record. There is nothing contradicting that. And so, you know, I would refer the court, I believe it's the Wilson case, I may be wrong about that, but there's one of the cases in our briefs where the court basically says, the trial court interpreted a juror's statement of bias as the juror just trying to get out of jury duty. And the trial court says, you know, I'm the trial court, and I find this guy just really doesn't want to serve. The appellate court says, there's nothing in the record. We can't defer to that. I think that's kind of the scenario we're under here.
Ms. Johnson, let me ask you another finding of the court said that the juror did not say he would not judge the evidence fairly. Does a juror have to say that in order to be challengeable?
No, I think any statement of bias under the statute, under Rule 24, and under the case law is sufficient to require either rehabilitation, which is lacking here, or dismissal. The trial court also made an express finding that there were no statements of impartiality, but that is frankly just flatly contradicted by the record. That's, I think, is clear on the record before the court. Similarly, there are problems with prospective juror B. Prospective juror B was the juror who repeatedly, I believe four times, said that he needed to hear both sides of the evidence. And there had been a signal or a comment from defense counsel that it was likely Mr. Montero Romero would not testify at trial. And both prospective juror S, as well as juror B, expressed discomfort with the notion that they would not be able to hear from Mr. Montero Romero, again suggesting that they were unable to apply the basic principles of criminal law that would be instructed by the district court and that were instructed by the district court, namely, the defendant has a constitutional right not to testify and not to have that held against him in any way, as well as the fundamental burden of proof always remaining with the prosecution. If I could briefly address the instructional issues as well. In Roman 2 of our brief, we've also explained why Mr. Montero Romero's convictions need to be reversed because of the flawed and very individualized self-defense instruction in this case. What the court did in this case was to import some of the Make My Day statutory language, but not all of it, into Mr. Montero Romero's affirmative defense of self-defense instruction.
I have a quick question to ask you about preservation of that instructional error. When you say in your brief that they objected, did they object to the importation of Make My Day in its entirety, or did they make a specific objection that the court was leaving out some of the Make My Day law?
I believe it was the former, Your Honor. But I believe that is still adequately preserved. And frankly, even under a plain error standard here, I think if the court reviews, we have a footnote on a brief where we say, you know, the Colorado courts have really been very vigorous about ensuring that self-defense is adequately instructed to juries in this state. And some, not all of those cases are plain error cases because the self-defense instruction goes to the heart of what this case is about. And it impacts both the assault conviction as well as the burglary conviction because the burglary instruction sort of imports the assault principles. So we think it requires reversal of both of those instructions. If the court has no further questions at this time, I will save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. Let me just go with this sound a little funny. Carmen Moralita for the people. My attorney registration is 34852. I am aware, Your Honors, that this is not the easiest record to defend as it pertains to the juror challenge for cause. However, there is enough in the record to support the trial court's use of discretion in this case to deny the two challenges for cause. These two jurors, some of their statements and responses were somewhat equivocal. They say it may impact my decision one way or the other. So they were not unequivocal. They did not clearly express a bias and an inability to render a fair verdict. Both jurors indicated in the questionnaire that it could be impartial. In addition, the trial court was paying attention. I have read the whole voir dire. It was... Yes, Your Honor.
Fine. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, of course.
Right there, you said both jurors indicated in their responses that they could be impartial?
Well, it's an indication they did not state this, you know, explicitly.
They did not state they could not be impartial.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? But they didn't say, I can be impartial.
Yes, Your Honor. They didn't say that explicitly.
Okay.
So under your argument to express a clear bias, let's take juror S, for example, he would have to say that under any circumstances he would rule for the prosecution. It has to be that level of certainty.
I don't think so, Your Honor, but in this case, the fact that they provided some equivocal responses and the fact that the trial court made findings, credibility findings, and also was assessing this juror's demeanor, I think that is enough to support the court's denial in this case.
What would you identify as an equivocal response?
Well, in this case, as to your is, when the defense counsel asked, if a toss-up in your mind, would you side with the prosecution? And he said, it may. I know it's not much, Your Honor, but that's what I think. It's what the trial court was considering, especially when all of the other jurors were providing statements where they were very strong, like, you know, I can't, I shan't. There was no question that those jurors had a clear bias, and they were just not willing to do it. They said, I just can't do this.
But juror S did follow up that what you call equivocal response by responding to another question as to if it's a toss-up in your mind, you'll likely go towards the prosecution, and juror S said, yes, strong chance.
Yes, Your Honor. He also said that I'm just hanging my hat on the it may. Because, again, the court could have made better findings. The court could have granted those challenges for cause. But as long as there's something in the record, this court, I think, should affirm the trial court. And again, I said the court could have made better findings. But the other thing that I wanted to bring to the court's attention is this: the trial court was granting challenges for cause. The juror who clearly expressed a bias was making credibility findings, was explicitly also making factual findings on demeanor. And as to juror S, he specifically, you know, he used the words, he's trying to be conscientious. He exhibits that he wants to be honest. He wants to be forthright. And that indicates a credibility finding and also an assessment of this juror's demeanors to which this court should defer. And based on some of the equivocal responses and also on the demeanor, the trial court believed that those words and statements were an attempt on the part of this juror to be honest, to be forthright, rather than an implication or indication that they could not render a fair and impartial verdict, especially when they had indicated in the questionnaire that it could be impartial. And I'm not going to lecture you on the law, but you know that the trial court is in the best position to assess the state of mind of a prospective juror through a personal observation and evaluation of the jurors. And what I'm asking this court is to strike a balance between meaningful appellate review and meaningful deference to the trial court.
I'd like to shift gears for a minute and go to the instructional error.
Yes.
You agree that the court did not include all the statutory elements of the Make My Day law, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your argument is that the finding on the burglary compensated for that somehow?
The self-defense did not apply to the burglar instruction. Even though the burglar instruction was somehow linked to the assault, it required the defendant to have the intent to commit first-degree burglary. But Your Honors, first-degree burglary is consummated or is complete once the defendant unlawfully enters a occupied structure with the intent, with the required intent. So my position is that the assault and self-defense did not apply to burglary. In any case, my position is that even any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, even under the constitutional harmless error standard, because the evidence of guilt was overwhelming. And the evidence of self-defense was really lacking, other than the defendant's self-serving statement that his ex-girlfriend and victim tried to assault him. There's no evidence of that. The defendant, the evidence is that the day before the incident, the ex-girlfriend was afraid that he could come in. They either talked about or put a chair against the door. That indicates that he unlawfully entered the building. He did not have, he wasn't invited, he wasn't privileged.
The left out portion of the make my day didn't really go to the unlawful entry. It went more to the unlawfulness of the actions taken against him, right?
The part that was left out is the second element, which requires that the occupant of the structure has a reasonable belief that the, in this case, the defendant either had committed, was committing, or had the intent to commit. So you don't really need a consummated crime, only that the person reasonably believes that is going to commit a crime.
Is the defendant's intent to commit a crime the same thing as the other person's reasonable belief that he's going to commit a crime?
If it's the same, if you could rephrase the question, I don't think I understand.
As I understand your argument, you're saying the fact that the jury convicted of first-degree burglary, which required them to find that he had an intent to commit a crime, mm-hmm. namely assault, mm-hmm. and that here they were also instructed that he actually assaulted. And I'm understanding that you're saying that those findings cured the problem where they weren't asked to determine the reasonableness of the belief of the person, the man who was inside the house, the victim. So it's hard in this case because the make my day is kind of in a reverse configuration. But I'm saying is the victim's reasonable belief about whether he has what this person is going to do, is that the same thing necessarily as what's in the person's mind?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the same thing, but in the jury, in finding that the defendant had the intent to commit first degree assault, that creates a strong presumption that they found that the victim's reasonable belief, you know, had a reasonable belief that he intended to commit a crime.
If the assault was justified by self-defense, was it a crime?
I don't think the self-defense applied to the burglary instruction. All it was required was the intent to commit the first degree assault. Even though the instructions, one of the elements that was that the defendant assaulted the victim. I don't think that the self-defense applied to the burglary instruction. It's kind of complicated, but my point is that the burglary was consummated once the defendant lawfully entered the building with the required intent. But again, even if there was some error in the instruction journal, the evidence was overwhelming that the defendant actually unlawfully entered the occupant structure and that he assaulted the victim. He stabbed the victim.
Well, I think the problem with that last statement is self-defense is a justification, mm-hmm. because a crime theoretically would have been completed, but there's a justification for that crime.
Yes, and I'm going to say, as I say, there's really no evidence of self-defense in the record. So even any error in instructions, the defendant, again, I was saying before, the day before, the girlfriend was scared, they put a chair against the door, the defendant came in, he talked with the ex-girlfriend first. The victim was in the bedroom. He heard something was wrong. And then the defendant made his way into the bedroom where the victim was with a knife. I think the evidence, the record supports that he entered unlawfully. So once the defendant makes an unlawful entry into the building, the law presumes that he knew that the victim could use lethal force to defend himself. So therefore, self-defense does not kick in. In addition to that, I think the record supports that he was the initial aggressor, that he never withdrew from the encounter. He never communicated he was going to withdraw, and there was no evidence that the victim continued the threat or any assault on the defendant. On the contrary, the evidence supports that the victim, as soon as he could, he got out of the bed and he got out of the apartment. So that's why I say that even any error in instruction as to self-defense, there is no evidence in self-defense other than the defendant's self-serving statement that his ex-girlfriend and victim assaulted him. Any other questions as to that? If this court doesn't have any other questions, I would like to request that the judgment or conviction be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Johnson, you have about 6.5 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try hard not to use all of them. I direct the court's attention to instruction number 20, which is at volume 1, page 88 of the record. That's the elemental instruction for first-degree burglary in this case. And there are seven elements listed. Element number 7 is, quote, the defendant assaulted Frank Gonzalez. So that's precisely where the assault gets imported into the burglary instruction, and the errors of the self-defense instruction infect and vitiate the first-degree burglary conviction. Not surprisingly, I disagree with the government's statement that the evidence was overwhelming here, that apparently Mr. Montero-Romero did not act in self-defense. I'm not sure it advances the ball to say that these were self-serving statements. Clearly, when there's an assault, the statements on both sides are rather self-serving. There were contemporaneous statements by Mr. Montero-Romero, not only to law enforcement, but to his employer. And I would also refer the court to the record at volume 8, pages 42 to 43. That's where, on cross-examination, Mr. Gonzalez, the alleged victim in this case, admitted that he told a police detective that he had seen the knife that Mr. Montero Romero was holding only after Mr. Gonzalez had started a physical struggle with Mr. Montero Romero. And I think
in this case used a key to enter, correct? Given to him by his ex-girlfriend.
That's correct. This is a very different scenario from a kind of stranger burglary enter. This is a girlfriend / common law wife. He had been given a key. There's not really very specific testimony about this door, whether how it was, the chair, in front of the door. And clearly there's abundant evidence in the record, I think, that Mr. Montero Romero was surprised and shocked. And of course, understandably, Mr. Gonzalez was. He'd only been asleep for 4 hours. He had been intoxicated when he went to sleep. He had been using cocaine. That's all in the record. So I do think that there's, certainly the district court correctly found that there was adequate evidence of self-defense to merit an instruction, and I think the issue here is, was the jury properly instructed? Unfortunately, they were not. With respect to the with respect to the challenges for cause, again, I think we pointed out in our reply brief, there is abundant Colorado case law in this area that the government simply doesn't address. The Wilson case says reversible error occurs when a trial court does not grant a challenge for cause to a prospective juror who expresses doubt as to his or her ability to be impartial and is not rehabilitated by the prosecution of the trial court. That's the standard. Again, this court in the Zarenko case in 1991 looked to the prospective jurors' final responses on voir dire and the fact that in that case they indicated a clear expression of bias. So I don't think anything that's stated on the forum questionnaire matters anymore. Once juror S is in the courtroom under oath and says, I have a bias in favor of the police and the prosecutor, that juror needs to be rehabilitated or that juror needs to be struck. Again, similarly in Sandoval, this court in 1985 noted when it reversed convictions on this issue that the prospective juror did not, quote, clearly retreat from his position that he blamed the defendant for interrupting his vacation. And again, the government, I think, is requiring a level of absolute certainty about the bias that is frankly present here. It's that we have an unequivocal statement of bias. But even under less, more equivocal statements, the Colorado Supreme Court has found fit to reverse. For example, in Naylor, the juror in that case said, quote, "I don't think I could be fair." And the Colorado Supreme Court found that was an abuse of discretion to refuse to dismiss that juror for cause. Unless the court has any further questions, we would ask that Mr. Montero Romero's convictions be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. Those will be helpful to us in rendering an opinion. And this matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.